I've discovered that the later in the week that you give your talk, the more you discover that other people have given it already. I can leave out some stuff, which is good. What I'd like to do is, there's two things really, is to provide an overview of where we are with parton distribution functions, PDF, with specific reference to Hadron Collider phenomenology, and then highlights just a selection of issues which I think are important for us to get to grips with in the next year or two, specifically coming up to the LHC startup. And it's great that there will be, after this week and for the next few weeks here, many of the experts in this field. And so I'm looking forward to a lot of progress on some of these issues. So I will just kind of highlight the problems in some areas and then not give answers, because I think that will require some discussion over the next month. Okay. So as you've already heard many times at the meeting, the idea of being able to make precision predictions in QCD for Hadron Collider cross-sections all rests on this famous factorization theorem that George and colleagues proved for us many years ago. And a central component of the factorization theorem are these distributions describing the way the momentum of the proton is shared among its constituents, the parton distribution functions. Now, if I had a pointer, good point. Okay, so these are the things that you've heard about already. These functions depend on the momentum fraction and the scale. They are convoluted with hard scattering cross sections to calculate cross sections under the general heading of inclusive hard scattering or short distance cross sections. Now, there's two aspects of this, and of course I'll concentrate on the PDFs. We've already heard about the subprocess cross sections, how you try and calculate those either to some fixed order or by resummation or some combination of both. But just focusing on the parton distributions, it's very simple that once you know what you're producing, say a heavy object of a mass m, and what rapidity you're producing it at, then the parton momentum fractions, x1 and x2, are fixed. So that means that one can then produce a plot like this, which is just a very simple lookup table, which tells you what regions of x and q squared that you are going to be sensitive to in your favorite LHC or Tevatron cross-section. So this is a plot specifically for the LHC, and for example, it tells you that if you want to make an object like a Z-prime, the mass of 1 TeV, at central rapidity, y equals 0, then you are going to be sensitive to parton distributions at x equals whatever, 0.07 or something like that, and q squared of 10 to the 6. Another example, if you're interested in W bosons produced at large rapidity, then one of your partons x's is going to be large, other one's going to be small. So a W produced at, say, y equals 4 has one of its x's here and the other x here. So that's the table, and we'll come back at least implicitly to that as we go through the talk. Now, just one comment that's written at the bottom of this transparency. This factorization theorem is a wonderful thing, but it does come with a kind of health warning, which says make sure that the event that you're, or the process that you're considering, is indeed inclusive enough. Once you start asking more exclusive questions about an event, like rapidity gap, asking for rapidity gaps, or events with certain particle multiplicities and so on, then you're in grave danger of breaking the factorization. And I will not be talking here, for example, about things like diffractive parton distributions, for which it now seems really clear that there is no analogous factorization between, say, a lepton-hadron collider and a hadron-hadron collider. Okay, so parton distributions, where do they come from? They come from global fits, and what is the technology that's relevant there? The main source of information on these parton distributions is, of course, the structure functions measured in deep inelastic scattering. There are a variety of these things, F2, F3, and so on. They're all combinations of parton distributions. So here are these things called coefficient functions multiplying the parton distributions to give you whatever structure function you're interested in. So lots of data on structure functions, and this can be inverted to to get information on the individual parton distributions. We also nowadays use not only structure function data, but hadronic cross-section data. Jet data, for example, data on W production, are also used in as input into the global fit to plan pin down the partons. And last but not least, and which should have been evident from this this plot showing the X's, if, for example, you're at the LHC, then a feature is, I should have mentioned this, that as a rule of thumb, you are sensitive to parton distributions at values of X at which you have already measured them in deep inelastic scattering. Okay, so wherever you are in this triangle, you've probably measured it already in DIS. But what is different is that you're generally at higher Q squared. So we need some reliable way of evolving our parton distributions from the lower Q squareds where they're measured in deep inelastic scattering, for example, up to the higher Q squareds where they're likely to be probed. And the thing, of course, that does that is the DGLAP formalism, DGLAP evolution. Here it is, written down at leading order. We all, everybody in this room presumably knows this, and so I'll not say anything more, except that the whole formalism and also the DGLAP evolution has to be cast at some particular order in perturbation theory, the same order for the coefficient functions as for the evolution equations for consistency. And almost everything I say in this talk will refer to next to leading order, where coefficient functions are evaluated to alpha s, and splitting functions are evaluated to order alpha s squared. Now, that's not actually where the frontier. The frontier of the subject is next to next leading order. We still do not have the complete next to next leading order formalism. There are various bits missing, particularly as regards to the hadronic cross-sections that are inputted into the global fit. You will hear more about the challenges in doing a complete next to next leading order calculation in the next talk from Sven. I will not say anything more in any detail about next to next leading order. I'll mention it now and then, just as a comment on how the fit might differ at NNLO compared to NLO. But by and large, I'll focus on NLO. Okay. Recent work, I've tried to make a comprehensive list of what's been going on in this subject. I make no mention of attempts to calculate parton distributions from first principles in non-perturbative models, lattice calculations, and so on. These are very focusing on the phenomenology, so focusing on those groups who are trying to derive parton distributions and their errors from experimental data. So, at the top, I mentioned H1 and Zeus. You heard about this from Gunther on the first day. The reason we know so much about PDFs these days is a large part due to the heroic efforts of H1 and Zeus in accumulating lots of data on structure functions in the last 10 years. And H1 and Zeus, as you saw in Gunther's talk, do their own fits and extract quarks and gluons and so on. Two groups here, CTEC and MRST, are more or less doing the same thing. Accumulating as much data as they can get their hands on and cranking the handle in the context of a global analysis. And by the very nature of this sort of work, you're always updating it. So as soon as there's new data, you put it in the box and extract updated parton distributions. But I've just written here some recent papers that have been written by these groups. And you'll see that a lot of the recent discussion has been on the uncertainties, not just the best fit, but the uncertainties on the PDFs, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. So we've done that in MRST. CTEC have had a big update 2 years ago, which gave the CTEC 6 sets you heard about, and then more recently a couple of papers focusing on various aspects, high ET jet cross section of the Tevatron, and one which I hope I find time to talk about, the strangeness asymmetry, which is a fairly new development in this game. Gila Keller crossover, a very nice analysis of statistical analysis of the uncertainties on the parton distributions. I will mention that's not quite on as large a set of data as the other two. Aljochen as well, again a global fit to a large fraction of the data that the MRST and CTEC people use, again focusing on the uncertainties, the higher twist contributions, and so on, and also a quasi-NNLO fit like MRST have done as well. I mentioned that if you're interested, if you want to compare any of these distributions, or the CTEC 6 with the CTEC 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, whatever, then you'll find all of them basically archived on this HepData database in Durham, run by Mike Woolley. So he has accumulated a server from which you can download most of the codes you'd ever want to use these PDFs. And as was already mentioned, I think in Joey's talk, it has also become the home of the LHA PDF project. Another nice thing you can do with this database archive is that you can compare very easily PDFs. You can just dial up. You want to find the difference between the MRST, the Alyokin, the CTEC, the GRV gluon. You just dial it up, press the button, and out will come a figure. And I'll show you an example later on of the figure that pops out. So it's a very easy way. Why is your cross-section different when you use CTEC or Alyokin? Look at the parton distributions here. You can often find the answer to questions like that almost instantly from the printout. Now, I mentioned that the set of data, the variety of data that are used in the FITs, here is a more or less comprehensive set. So everybody in this business uses at least some fraction of this set, and MRST and CTEC use basically all of it. Now, at the top I've written the DIS structure function data, and that's great for determining particularly directly the quarks through the relation between the structure functions and the quarks, and also through the dGLAP evolution, the gluon distribution, where it dominates dGLAP evolution, i.e. at medium and small x. So that's, if you like, the primary source of information, and this data represents, whatever, 20, almost 30 years, 30 years of effort on the experimental side. At the bottom of the slide, you have the more specialized inputs which determine particular aspects. The charm distribution, well, you can get it directly from F2Charm in DIS. Drellian data has traditionally been a great help in this game, especially for anti-quarks at large X, and also indirectly gluons at large X. Drellian asymmetries, now we're asking more detailed questions between U-bar and D-bar, can be measured in Drellian. And the W rapidity asymmetry, the Tevatron, a nice way of pinning down the U to D ratio. Very important, of course, the inclusive jet data for the only clean measure of the gluon at high X. And then, as we're going to hear a bit more about, the things like the dimuon cross-section is measured in the neutrino experiments, which constrain the C quarks. Another comment here at the bottom. Nowadays, in contrast to 10 years ago, you don't find any prompt photon data in these FITs. Now, that may change, but that's the way that nobody, as far as I know, puts prompt photon data in their FITs because of theoretical problems, or rather uncertainties in the theoretical cross-sections. Okay, now the method and assumptions, well, it's fairly straightforward. First of all, you've got to choose a factorization scheme, a theoretical framework, and a particular order, and everything in this talk will refer to the MS-bar factorization and renormalization schemes at NLO, as already said. You collect together your data, you perform a global fit by minimizing the chi-squared, including as best a treatment as you can of the statistical and systematic errors that are on the data that you're inputting. You start the evolution at some Q0 squared where you think that leading twist dGLAP makes sense, or close to such a point where you think it makes sense. And at that Q0 squared, your starting scale, you choose some functional form for the PDFs. Here is a typical one. You can use more sophisticated ones, but by and large, and I've just realized I've forgotten the normalizations. So by and large, 5 parameters per parton flavor. So what have we got? 5 quarks and a gluon 6. So roughly 30 parameters are sufficient to parameterize everything. Then you've got to decide what data you're going to put in the fit. I'll come back to that. But you choose some Q squared min, some W squared min to avoid things like higher twist. Nowadays, the data tell you quite clearly that U-bar is not the same as D-bar, so you better allow for that in your parameterization. As you will see, it also looks as if S is not equal to S-bar, so in future we'll probably have to allow for that. And then for the heavy quarks, charm the bottom quarks, one needs a treatment which incorporates the finite quark mass, and nowadays the treatment of choice is called the variable flavor number scheme, which is... that's an improvement on previous fixed flavor or zero mass schemes. and that is theoretically consistent and allows one to understand the heavy quark data. I'll not say anything more about AlphaS because Siggy has said everything you need to know about AlphaS, but typically as a byproduct of these global fits, one does get a value of AlphaS, and you know, depending on what you fit, who you fit, and so on, you get values consistent, which are more or less consistent with the world averages, as we saw. Now, I could have shown you any one of these groups' latest partons, and you wouldn't be able to tell them apart because they're all more or less the same, because they're all more or less fitting the same data. So I'll just choose one I had already. This is the MRST picture of a couple of years ago showing you what they look like, these PDFs, as a function of x at q squared of 10. You see what you might expect, the ups, the downs, the valence components of the ups and the downs here. You see that at small x, all the quarks are becoming the same, having sort of a universal thing. But even at q squared of 10, there's a clear suppression for the strange compared to the up and the down. In the C, here's the U bar and D bar being different at medium and large x. And here's the charm down here. And then the gluon, which is, of course, by far and away the majority carrier of the momentum. The gluon distribution is shown in this green line going off the top. So at small x, it's all basically glue. Now, PDF uncertainty. So that's a kind of an so far that's an overview. PDF uncertainties. This is the topic of the last 4 or 5 years in this subject. Moving away from, see, in the old days, you wanted to gauge the PDF uncertainty on your cross-section, your favorite cross-section, so you just took six off the shelf, you know, CTEC, MRS, GRV, whatever. You got six different predictions and you sort of waved your hands and said that, well, that's probably a measure of the uncertainty. But nowadays, it's much more sophisticated. Currently receiving a lot of attention. We had a nice workshop. We piggybacked on a statistics workshop in Durham, statistics and particle physics workshop in Durham a couple of years ago, well, a year and a half ago, and had a discussion, had representatives from many of the people working in this area on PDF uncertainties. If you want to see a summary of what's, because I can only sort of scratch the surface, and that's a nice reference for more or less where we are in this game. But there's two, I just want to, in fact, no, because Joey mentioned the Hessian approach, so I'll maybe skip that. I'll just mention some of the other methods here. But by and large, they fall into two classes. You can either produce sets of partons which are designed to somehow span the allowed values of the particular distribution. So if I show you things like this, which is an output from the Hessian, the CTEC Hessian approach, there you see at any x you get a band for the gluon. You can see how that band changes with q-squared evolution. And that's done by the Hessian approach by expanding the parameters quadratically about their best fit value and diagonalizing the matrix and looking at the important eigendirections, rescaling the eigenvalues, so that you have plus and minus PDFs for every parameter in principle or some large fraction of the parameters. And that gives you these bands of uncertainties. And that's the Hessian method, and CTEC and MRST are doing that. The statistical method of Gila, Kossor, and Keller is a kind of a variant of that because it focuses, it's the main focus there is an ensemble of parton distributions, each with its own likelihood, each with its own probability. So this is, in a way, a very pure, statistically accurate approach. It only takes a subset of the data. It uses a subset of the data for which one has a good understanding, good control over the statistical and systematic errors, and does not use data about which there might be problems to do with target mass corrections and so on. So this, in this particular fit, they're using a subset of the DIS data, proton DIS, proton target DIS data, as it says here. And the idea is to just build up a kind of an ensemble, a large number of parton distributions which span the relevant part of the parameter space, and each distribution has its own particular likelihood or probability. So then for a given observable, the mean value, the prediction for an observable, is just a weighted sum over the predictions using a given set multiplied by the probability distribution of that particular set and the variance then as well. Now, of course, to make this work, you need a large number. You've got to make sure you're spanning all the relevant space, and you need, at least in principle, a large number of sets to do this. I think as time goes on and the computers get more powerful and so on, this will not be an issue. And I think my view is that in the long term, this will be the way the subject will be going, that one will deal with a box, a black box containing sets of Parton distributions, and one will simply sum over those in a Monte Carlo way, the way you do with phase-based points and so on and so forth. So this will just be like another component of the phase space. Sorry? It's done by the from the fit to the data. The likelihood of a given set of, you know, you take a set, fit to the data, you get a chi-squared, a likelihood, and that determines how likely that set is. So I think that's probably the way we will all go in the end. But in the meantime, this Hessian approach of MRST and CTEC and Alyokin is to kind of identify the most important directions away from the best fit and use a Gaussian approximation with a plus or minus one sigma, or an attempt to do a plus or minus one sigma on the parameters. So you lock yourself into a kind of a Cartesian grid in the parameter space in that way. I want also to mention the Lagrange multiplier approach, because while these things are fine and are useful for sort of assessing the fact that the gluon is well known at this value of x and not so well known at the other value of x, of course, Parton distributions are not physical objects. In themselves, they have no meaning. They're not physical objects. They are sort of useful devices for taking you from one set of data, namely deep elastic scattering data, to predictions for things like the Higgs cross-section of the LHC. And so ultimately, what one is interested in are not the PDFs themselves, but the uncertainty on the cross-section that you're trying to predict at, say, the Tevatron on the LHC. And this fourth method, the so-called Lagrange multiplier method, really focuses on that. It says, take an observable and compute the uncertainty in that single observable due to the uncertainties which are generated by the uncertainties on the data that are in the global fit. So let me just say a few more words about that. This is a method which was developed by the CTEC people a few years ago and then was picked up by MRST. The idea, it's a constrained fit. So you take a quantity, let's consider, for example, the W cross-section at the Tevatron. And, well, of course, what you can do is do a global fit in the usual way, and you'll get a prediction for sigma W. But then if you say, well, let me do a fit in which sigma W, say, is constrained to have different values about the best fit prediction, then, of course, the fit will not be as good. It's not the best fit set anymore. But anyway, you get Parton distributions corresponding to fixed specific values of, in this case, sigma W, and you develop a chi-squared profile for that. And then, if you want, there's your best prediction, 21 point whatever, 7 or something, and the error is plus or minus how far you want to go up that chi-squared profile. The advantage is that you're focusing directly on the observable, and you're not relying on the Gaussian quadratic approximations of the parameters about the best fit values. The difficulty, and in fact it's a problem that not just applies to this, but all the other methods as well, is what you do for the delta, what you use for the delta chi-squared. Now, if you insist on putting all the data in the global fit, the JET data, the DIS data, the Drellian data, there is no way in which delta chi-squared of 1 makes any sense, okay? Because there are many uncertainties, there are many theoretical uncertainties when you're coming to try and predict these different cross-sections, that there is no way that you can combine them all in a statistically meaningful way without making theoretical assumptions, and therefore, not surprisingly, when you come to assess the delta chi-squared, which is relevant to get like a plus or minus one sigma or a two sigma uncertainty, you are really on your own. It's up to you. You have to rely on your own intuition as to what makes a sensible variation in chi-squared about the minimum. Now, to see this, you see this very graphically in a plot, if I can find, that CTEC produced, which shows you, if you attempt to do, in the top, here's alpha S, the contribution to alpha S, or the alpha S obtained from different parts of the fit. So here's what alpha S is according to the BCDMS data, the H1 data, the Zeus data, the CCFR, the JET data, and so on. And if you insist on delta chi squared equals 1, you see that these things are sprayed all over the place and there's no consistency between them. Okay, this is telling you that there's more to just the statistical and systematic errors for each individual experiment going on in the fit. If you, on the other hand, take delta chi-squared of, say, 100, then you find that the alpha s values line up in a way that looks kind of statistically reasonable. So that is why when CTEC do their fit, they use delta chi-squared of 100 to get their plus or minus uncertainty on the PDFs. MRST, for reasons which are hardly any better justified, choose delta chi-squared of 50. So if you're using these things, remember that at least in the context of the CTEC on the MRST fits, one has to remember that the appropriate delta chi-squared is largely a guess. Now it is that's maybe being a bit unfair. It's more than just a guess, but it is an attempt. I mean, one is using a very subjective approach to try and finding out what the best value of delta chi-squared is. Okay, in the MRST, delta chi-squared is 50 is chosen because that happens to be the delta chi-squared that if you move away from the best fit, at least one of the data sets in the fit starts to complain violently. So that gives you an idea of the sort of arguments that people are using. Okay, so I've showed you the Hessian approach, which gives you the band of PDFs. What about this? Some output from the the Lagrange multiplier approach. Okay, so if you use the Lagrange multiplier here, what I'm doing is focusing on the Higgs and the W cross sections only. So I'm not showing you the errors on the input partons that go into this plot. This is using the Lagrange multiplier approach to focus very directly on the error on sigma W and sigma Higgs. Now, these are the contours are the lines of different chi-squared. It shows you that the best fit prediction for these quantities is right here, but I've normalized that to zero. So this is the percentage change in the best fit cross-section. And what you can see is that if I accepted delta chi-squared of 50, that's this contour here, then I would be using this method predicting something like a 2%, plus or minus 2%, variation on the W cross-section from the uncertainties in the PDFs, and on the Higgs cross-section, well, actually not much more, plus or minus 2%. Fine. There's a little wrinkle to this in that one can either vary alpha s in the fit or keep alpha s fixed at some world value, and you can see that the uncertainty that you get varies a little bit on which of those two choices that you make. So that's an example of the Lagrange multiplier method at work, and we'll come back to that later. Now, here's, as I say, several groups are doing this, so here's now a plot from the Aljochin fits of 2002 with the PDFs, not moving back now to the PDF uncertainty. Of course, it's not very convenient to use the Lagrange multiplier method because there's so many cross-sections that you might be interested in. It is more useful, perhaps, in the context of, say, Hadron LHC cross-sections to focus on what are called the parton-parton luminosities. So these are the uncertainties, then, on the particular products of parton distributions here, the QQ-bar combination, which would make a W or a Z or a Z prime, or the glue-glue combination that would make, for example, a Higgs or a TT-bar pair. So the parton luminosities also, of course, have uncertainties on them, which are directly related to the uncertainties on the PDFs. And here is Aljochin's prediction for the plus or minus uncertainty on the various flavor of luminosities. Solid lines refer to the LHC, and the dashed lines to the Tevatron. So this, just to make contact with the previous plot, it should be said that the Hessian approach and the Lagrange multiplier approach give, by and large, compatible results. So for example, remember I had about a 2% prediction, 2% plus or minus 2% uncertainty in the W cross-section using the Lagrange multiplier method according to MRST. If I look at this, and here, I mean, if I wanted a similar sort of thing read off this plot, I'd use the QQ bar luminosity at mass of 100 about here, and you can at the LHC, and you can see again the prediction is for about a 2% uncertainty on that particular cross section. So down here we have the QQ bar cross sections, and you can see the thing that's very striking is that for a large part of the mass range that one is interested in, basically from 10 up to 1,000, the predicted uncertainty on the cross-section from PDFs is of the order of 2%, between 2 and 3%. And that is, I think, one can regard that as a great triumph from this subject over the last 20, 30 years, that the precision has improved to that extent, and it's largely driven, of course, by the very accurate DIS data that go into the FITs. For the gluon distribution, you might be, you know, the folklore is that the gluon is much less well determined. That's not true. It might be true at large X, but again, over a large range of relevant masses between 10 psi and a TV, the uncertainty in gluon-driven processes is again of order a few percent. And you can see here in this plot, if you are interested in producing an object, say a Higgs of mass 200 GeV, then the predicted uncertainty here is significantly less than plus or minus 2%. Why is that? Well, again, because I already mentioned the precision DIS data in the FIT does give you via the Deaglap equation precision information on the gluons. It's the slope of F2 that is giving you the precise information on the gluon, and it's not much worse than the uncertainty on the quarks, which are fit directly by the structure functions. What is different, what is less certain, of course, is the gluon at high X, and why these lines are going up here. When you get to high X in the gluon, then you do find larger uncertainties. Now, here is a place where you can see, for example, the difference between the Liao-Yokin way of doing it and the MRST. Because here is the MRST parton luminosity, so basically the same thing that's being studied. And in blue here you have the MRST uncertainty for the glu-glu luminosity. And for masses up to about 1,000, these results here basically agree with these ones here. When you get to large mass, you'll see that the blue line here, the MRST luminosity uncertainty, is quite a bit less than the Liao-Yokin one. The reason is very simple. It's because in the MRST fit, Tevatron jet data are used to constrain the gluon at large X, whereas those data are not used in the Liao-Yokin fit, and that is simply why the uncertainty is larger in one case than in the other. Okay. Now, that's fine, but that's in a way the easy bit in the sense of taking the errors on the input data and assessing the effect on the PDFs or the cross sections. Where it gets a bit trickier is when you move on to the fundamental and, you might argue, the most important question of all, and that is, well, that's all very well, but why is it that when I take the, here's that contour plot again, why is it when I take the MRST contours, I find that the CTEC prediction lies quite far away from the MRST prediction? So here is MRST, I'm quoting plus or minus whatever, 2% uncertainty, and the CTEC value is skewed very much to one side. Now, remember I said to you that the reason I'm comparing MRST and CTEC here is because they are the closest in approach. Okay? They are using more or less the same data set, more or less the same formalism, same flavor, almost the same variable flavor number scheme, so on and so forth, and yet still the central CTEC prediction is one sigma away from the best MRST prediction. Why is that? And that's where it gets complicated, and that's the part for which I have no good answers, and we'll be discussing, I think, over the coming weeks here. The reason is, of course, that there are more than just the experimental uncertainties involved in the PDFs. There are what one might call theoretical uncertainties to do with how one sets up the global fit. For example, if one wants to know why MRST and CTEC-6 and Liao-Yokin and GKK are all different, one has to look in down lists like this. What are the selection of data fitted? That's an obvious one. You select different data sets, you're going to get different partons and potentially different uncertainties. There are, of course, lurking at higher order logarithms, log 1 over x at small x, log 1 minus x at large x. There are higher twist contributions. There are input assumptions to do with the choice of your parameterization, how you treat the heavy target corrections, what you assume about isospin, strange anti-strange asymmetry, and so on and so on and so on. And it is these kind of details and the way they are treated in the different approaches that gives rise to differences in the predicted partons. It's as simple as that. So what we've done recently in an MRST study is looked at some of these to try and get an idea of what additional uncertainties we must include over and above the experimental uncertainties that we've been talking about so far to get a true uncertainty on a PDF or on a particular cross-section. Now, I'll not go into too much detail on this because I'm running out of time, but just to give you an idea of what we tried to do and what we find and why it might be a bit worrying. And that is, it's the issue of what happened. How much time have I got?
We started right at 2. So we have
10 minutes. Okay. So what we did, which as I said led us to get a bit worried of what was going on here, was to see how sensitive the PDF fit was to our assumption about the minimum X and the minimum Q squared of the data in the fit. What we did in particular was we removed data systematically from the fit to see, this is removed systematically DIS data from the global fit to see what happened. Now, there has always been in the last few years, if you're determined to put the Tevatron jet data into the fit, you will find a tension, a small but definitely there tension between the DIS data and the jet data in the fit. And the reason is that everybody would like to have lots of glue at the different regions in X. The Tevatron jet data like a large glue at high X. The DIS data at medium X like a large glue. And the DIS data at small X like a large glue. And unfortunately, you've got the momentum sum rule constraining you from just throwing in arbitrary amounts of glue on at any value of X that you like. So this tension that has been noticeable in the fits of the last few years is the reason why when you start removing data at small x and small q squared from the fit, why the fit gets dramatically better. So what we did was we started with our canonical set of cuts. In other words, we take all x data and a q squared cut of 2 and systematically increased those to remove data from the fit and noticed that this quality of the fit got significantly better as we put up the Q squared and put up the X cut, until we were in a region of an X cut of around 0.005, so having removed a large fraction of the HERA data, and a Q squared cut of 10, well, ditto, and find that once we got to that point, the fit became stable. Its quality didn't change if you started removing more data from the fit. Now, and we called this resulting set of partons from that fit a conservative set of partons. We had taken like a conservative fiducial region in X and Q squared to assess to what extent there was something else going on at the small X and small Q squared that we'd omitted. Now, what we found was something not very surprising, that the minute that you remove data at small X and small Q squared from the fit, the gluon in that region, there's now no longer any data, gets much smaller. Decides to be much smaller, it doesn't have to fit any data, it's as small as it can. Why does it get as small as it can in that region? Because it wants more, it's able now to put more glue at medium X and large X to improve the fit to the other data sets. Now, so there we have a conservative set of partons versus the default set of partons, and you can see they are quite different. Now, the implications of this, I think, are quite significant, because it may be that this is telling us that there is a problem with our formalism, theoretical formalism for small x in the DIS fit. There maybe are, maybe this is evidence of higher order contributions like alpha s to the 4, log to the 4, 1 over x, and so on and so forth, the ones that are predicted by the BFKL formalism, and that maybe one has to take those into account in order to recover a fit which has equally good quality over all the x and q squared range. So why do we mention this in the context of collider phenomenology? Well, I just raise it because it may well be that one has to be careful in assessing the true uncertainty on predictions for the LHC which probe very small X quarks and gluons, for example, the W or the Higgs distribution at very large rapidity. Okay. So I think that further discussion of that is probably best deferred to next week. But it was at least an attempt by us to address one of the issues as to how sensitive the fit was to the assumptions about the cut on Q squared and X in the data. Now, time is moving on. 5 minutes. Let me just say something about the strange distribution, because that's another one of these new new features of the FIT, or the FITs in the last year. You've already heard from Guido about how there's this anomaly, this so-called anomaly between the NUTEV measurement of psi squared theta w and the world average. And the figures, the numbers to remember are there's about a 0.005 difference between the central values measured by NUTEV and the world average, so 0.005. And this picture is just another graphical representation of the fact that the extracted effective left and right couplings are different from the standard model. Now, the issue of the last year or two has been, is this new physics or not? And as you've already heard at this meeting, one has to be a little bit careful. The NUTEV measurement of sine squared theta w, the measurement that's published, the number that's quoted on previous transparency, makes several assumptions, entirely plausible assumptions, about the parton structure. For example, that there is isospin symmetry, that the up in the proton is the same as the down in the neutron, and that the C is strange, anti-strange, symmetric, which would be certainly everybody's first guess. If those were not true, if either of those assumptions was not correct, then the extracted value of sine squared theta w would change, according to some provided by the NUTEV people, a weight function multiplying the difference between S and S bar, or UP and DN, and so on and so on. In particular, if it was the case that S was bigger than S bar, around X of, let's say, 0.1, then sine squared theta w extracted would decrease and would head down towards the world average value. Now, this puts the focus of attention, clearly, on these fine details on the parton structure, and this is just what I want to finish off the talk with. Rather than talking about the NUTEV quantity, which the quantity that NUTEV actually measure, which gives rise to those weight functions which take into account the experimental acceptance and so on and so forth, one can more or less see what's going on by focusing on the theoretically simpler thing called the Pascal-Wolfenstein ratio, which is more or less, which is basically what the experiment is trying to get at, which says that this ratio of neutrino and antineutrino, neutral and charged current cross sections is a half minus sine squared theta w, so there's the extraction of sine squared theta w, but with all these corrections, all these small things one has to worry about, NLO QCD corrections, electroweak corrections, you've heard about these already in this conference, and the two things that I'm going to just focus on for a couple of minutes, the strange and the isospin violation corrections that we had on the previous transparency. Now, and the thing that helps you here, you have additional, let me focus first on the strange, anti-strange symmetry. The thing that helps you address that is the fact that the same experiment and CCFR before them also produced dimuon data, where they actually tagged the charm quark in the final state. Now, the dimuon data with neutrinos and antineutrinos allows you to get a handle on S and S bar in principle independently. So you have an independent measurement of S and S bar, and what the CTEC people did in this recent paper was to fit the dimuon data and to extract S minus S bar from that data. And what you find is, what they find is what's shown here in this red dash dot line being compared with what NUTEV extracted for S minus S bar and what an earlier study by Barone et al. Extracted. But the point is that in this fit, you see that indeed, at around x of 0.1, S is bigger than S bar. This quantity S minus is just the difference, S minus S bar. And so this fit, coming from the dimuon data, is implying that there is indeed a contribution to sine squared theta w of the right sign, SIGN, to take you closer to the world average. Now, and in fact, you heard this already, I think, in Joey's talk, that in fact, just to get a feeling of the normalization, they find that you could get a contribution to delta RS minus, and therefore to sine squared theta w, of an order with a sign and an order of magnitude of precisely one or two sigma relative to the NUTEV measurement. And so the conclusion there is that it's at least worth, and this is not, I emphasize that this, the study here, this quantity delta R minus is not what's measured by NUTEV, but this at least suggests that S not equal to S bar, as apparently implied by the dimuon data together with the constraint that the integral of S minus S bar has to be zero could be responsible for at least part of the Newtev so-called anomaly. The other part, and this is just the last thing to finish with, is that if you allow a little bit of isospin breaking in the nucleon structure functions, now you can, I'm just looking at this here from a purely phenomenological point of view, so there are papers that have been written over the years about what you might expect in model for this isospin breaking, but if I take a purely empirical approach and say, well, let me add in a little bit by hand of isospin breaking, so UNV is no longer D, this is for the valence quark, just an example, so U valence quark, an up valence quark in the neutron is not the down valence quark in the proton, but I let it differ a little bit, and then redo the global fit with this isospin violating term in, and then, of course, I find that the fit is going to be a little bit better, because I've got a few more degrees of freedom in there, but interestingly, I find that the best fit allowing isospin violation is, again, of exactly the right sign to change sine squared theta w in the right direction, and of magnitude to correspond to, again, a couple of one or two sigma, maybe, compared to the Newtev error. In fact, if you push things to the limit, you find you can get quite a large contribution to this delta R isospin violating contribution to the Pascal-Wolfenstein relation of either large and of either sign, in fact. But the best fit actually would give you a delta R minus iso of minus 0.002 or 3, which, as I say, is, again, one of these intriguingly, a number which is intriguingly close to the Newtev error. So my conclusion from this is that before we can definitively conclude that there is some new physics or some genuine anomaly going on, we will have to look in more detail at this detailed part on structure, because at first sight, as a result of these two studies, it appears that very minor tweaks to the part on structure can account for, well, most if not all, of the difference that is measured by Newtev. Okay, so I come to my concluding remarks. Okay, PDF uncertainty. Several groups are now producing parton distributions with uncertainties, and within each group there is a fairly well-defined procedure for calculating those uncertainties, but one still finds, comparing the best fit of one group with another, that the differences can lie outside the quoted individual errors for a particular group. This is certainly, has been demonstrated as being due to specific theoretical assumptions that are part and parcel of the fits, and these have to be understood in more detail, and workshops like these, like this, as I said, is ideal for getting to grips with these issues. I think that while parton distributions are interesting in themselves, and it's interesting to look at bands of uncertainty on individual distributions, the focus has to be on the effect of the uncertainties on the cross sections of interest, on the Higgs, the SUSY, whatever cross sections of the LHC and Tevatron. It's clear that in any complete analysis you will have to address not only the uncertainties coming from the experimental data input into the PDF global pit, but also try and somehow assess the theoretical uncertainties that are coming from the various assumptions or various unknowns that are part and parcel of these many of these fits. I think that we are beginning to see first signs that there's something else going on at small x other than just NLO DGLAP. If that is the case, we will have to take it into account somehow in these fits. Sine squared theta w from neutrino scattering, it may be not the most glamorous or exciting result, but it could well be that the explanation of this is just due to some detailed effects in parton structure. Those of us who have been working in parton distributions in the last, well, can't care to remember, number of years, would find that just as exciting, actually. When Duke and Owen started off in 1980, was it? They had U bar equals D bar equals S bar equals S in the fit. And we've come such a long way since then. We definitely U bar is not equal to D bar, although whether it is at small x is an unknown. And it now seems that S isn't equal to S bar. So that is exciting, and no doubt will give rise to loads of theory papers coming up with models as to why that is the case. Is C equals C bar? Is B equals B bar? Well, who knows? And I didn't get a chance to talk about QED effects in PDFs. The message is there is in 10 seconds, yes, you can do it, no, it doesn't have a very big effect. Okay, thank you.
Questions for James? Yes.
James, concerning your conservative fits where you got rid of the DIS data, what happens if you do the opposite, namely you keep those in and you just forget about the JET data? You said that the fit will tend to improve. Will it improve more than it does following the other route?
To get an assessment of what the JET data does or doesn't do in the fit, the thing to do is to compare, say, the Ilyokhin PDFs with the MRFT or the CTEC PDF. Because you will see there differences both at large x, because in one case the JET data is constraining the gluon, in the other case it isn't, and also differences at small x because of the compensation, because of the sum rule. So I've forgotten your question. Sorry.
Well, the question was whether it was any better than, from the point of view of the overall analysis, would you rather having to get rid of either the small x, the DIS, or the JETs, what would you rather give up in terms of getting
example,
the best overall fit?
Well, let me answer that by a comment that what we did was we put in some empirical higher log x contributions at small x, and that restored the quality of the fit. So certainly you can put in alpha to the 4 log 4x, alpha to the 5 log 5 whatever x, throw in a few logs like that, let the fit determine the coefficients, and you get perfectly reasonable coefficients, and you restore the quality of the fit. So given that we know that such terms are there, this seems to me that that is the likely source of the problem. Now, unless somebody tells me that the JET, you know, CDF and D0 can't measure the JET cross-section at high ET, and they've got it wrong by 20% or something, well, I don't know. I believe them when they say that, you know, that's the measurement, those are the errors, but so my own view is that it's maybe something else at small x. That for years, I mean, has been masked by the fact that, you know, the errors on the data were large. It's the errors on the F2 have come down to such an extent that maybe we're beginning to see these effects, you know, finally.
I'm curious to know, how do you do this cutting small x and small q square? Because the two should be correlated. For high enough Q square, you can go much down, much more down in X. So, for example, so what do you do actually? For example, a Q square equal 10. What is the minimum value of X where you have data? It is clear that to get to small x, you have to go to small q square also.
What we did was we did two things. We kept the q squared cut fixed at 2, so that's all the that's everything to the right of that line. And then threw away first this bin, 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 until 0.005 would have been the next bin. So what we did was the first part of the exercise was to remove all of this data from the fit and keep all of the DIS data above this X bin in the fit. Now, the lines here are relevant because the dashed line is the fit which doesn't have these data in it. So you can still look at what it's predicting for F2, but because the F2 data aren't in the dashed line fit, you can see that it does a pretty miserable job, right? Now, if I was to throw in some log 1 over X's on top of that dashed blue line, it would again fit the data. That was the comment about that. The black line is still doing its best. It's still the standard global fit, put all the data in. So there's the difference between a fit which has these data in it and a fit which doesn't. The second part of the exercise was to start throwing away the data at small q squared, because increasing the cut from 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And again, once we find that we got to q squared of 10, the quality of the fit didn't really change anymore. And we changed the order of doing those two things and tried putting cuts in x times q squared and w squared and all sorts of things. But I think the bottom line is that we reckon that there is some kind of fiducial region above 0.005 and above q squared of 10 where the Dieglap fit works perfectly.
Well, again, on the same issue, what happens to the tension between the jet data and the deep inelastic low x data if you include next to leading order, which means next to leading order coefficient functions for the deep inelastic and next to leading order approximated splitting functions? Is this tension eased, or is it further reinforced?
It's not really eased. The CTEC people can comment, but the quality of the NNLO fit is not much different from the quality of the NLO fit. Not much. It's not a true NNLO fit for two reasons. It's, as Sven will say, we don't have the full splitting functions. I don't think that's likely to be the issue. I think the major defect at the moment is the lack of the coefficient function for the jet cross section. But in contrast, where a leading order fit just doesn't work these days. I mean, from leading order, a leading order global fit is useless, right? The chi-squared is enormous. An NLO global fit is not bad, and an NNLO, NNLO one quasi is not much better than NLO. Although, having said that, let me make it a little bit more complicated by saying when you do this exercise of throwing away data at small x, you find that the partons that you're left with, these conservative sets, differ less at NNLO than at NLO. Now that suggests, that's good, because that would be, if the reason why the fit is having problems is because of higher order log 1 over x contributions, they are certainly in the NNLO contribution, and therefore you wouldn't be surprised that somehow already some of that effect is taken into account, and therefore the partons don't change as much at NNLO.
Okay. Is it quick?
Yeah. James, in view of the fact that diffraction scattering plays a large role in deep inelastic scattering, shouldn't one take that into account? I mean, the effect will be that the rapidity space over which you can evolve or emit gluons is reduced.
I mean, the folklore is, this is just my, other people might have comments. I mean, we traditionally do not remove diffractive F2 from F2 before we fit it, because we are trying to be as inclusive as possible, and we believe that the diffractive F2, the 10% contribution, is part of the inclusive F2, and therefore this formalism applies to it. So, if I go to the Hadron Collider and predict the W cross section, I'm predicting the W cross section, including those events in which there are rapidity gaps.
But we know that gluon emission can only occur over really reduced
gluon. Yeah. But that's part of the phase space for gluon emission.
Sounds like a good topic for the break, which is after our next talk. Thank you again, James.